Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
Hey, hast du heute Nacht gut geschlafen? Und deine Haut auch? Stell dir vor, du erlebst den Haka-Effekt. Deine Wäsche riecht einfach frisch, ganz ohne chemische Duftwolke. Und deine Haut atmet auf. Beim Putzen musst du nicht husten, sondern kannst einfach durchatmen. Das ist der Moment, in dem du spürst, sauber geht auch anders. Mit Haka. Unbedenklich, hautfreundlich und dennoch wirksam. Probiere den Haka-Effekt für Sauberkeit, die sich gut anfühlt. Jetzt entdecken auf haka.com.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Anna Stubblefield? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Marjorie Anna Stubblefield was born in December 1969 and raised in Plymouth, Michigan. She went by the name Anna. Both her parents earned PhDs and studied special education. They had an interest in people with disabilities. Anna shared this interest as well as one in race. In June 1989, when Anna was in college, she married a black tuba player named Roger Stubblefield. Later, they would go on to have two children. In 2000, Anna earned a PhD. She found work as a professor at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey, and taught in the American Studies doctoral program. One of Anna's students was a man named John Johnson. He was studying to get his PhD after earning his master's degree in history. During a class in 2009, Anna played a film about a nonverbal girl with a very low IQ score. Supposedly, the girl had been helped using a technique called facilitated communication, which is sometimes referred to as FC. The debate around facilitated communication becomes important for this case, so I will offer a summary of its history. In 1974, a woman named Rosemary Crossley worked as an assistant at a mental health facility in Australia. She took an interest in a severely disabled girl who had a lot of difficulty communicating. In order to help the girl express herself, Rosemary had her point at photographs of objects and eventually to letters. The idea was to spell words and write sentences. The girl appeared to have tremendous success communicating using this method. A judge declared the girl to be competent to make her own decisions, and eventually she graduated from college. Her story was so inspiring, it drew attention to the method that Rosemary used to encourage communication. In 1990, a professor from the United States published a paper about the method. Facilitated communication was born, and word of its capabilities spread like wildfire among educators and mental health professionals. People flocked to workshops to learn about FC. It was a miracle, an awakening, and the dawn of a new era in treating people with severe cognitive disabilities. Eventually, however, the excitement faded because research indicated that FC did not actually aid in communication. If anything, it was a hindrance. It actually hurt people with disabilities. The party was over, and facilitated communication was widely condemned by mental health clinicians and academics. Moving back to the case of Anna Stubblefield, she had learned about FC years earlier and knew about its checkered past, but she believed that mental health professionals failed to appreciate its value. As I mentioned, Anna had a student named John Johnson who watched the film about FC. It piqued his interest because he had a brother named Derek who had cerebral palsy. Derek had severe limitations in functioning. For example, he was nonverbal, could only walk if assisted, wore diapers, and had spasms in his face, neck, torso, arms, and hands. In 2004, a mental health clinician determined that Derek's disability made intelligence testing impossible. The clinician determined that his comprehension was quite limited, and Derek could not even function at the level of a preschooler. John wondered if his brother would benefit from FC and asked Anna for her advice. She told him that she had attended a 3-day workshop on FC and thought she could help. In March 2009, John and Derek's mother, Daisy, brought Derek to Anna's office at Rutgers University. Anna asked Derek a series of questions involving pictures she had cut out from magazines. For example, she asked him in which room you would find the stove and showed him photographs of a bathroom, a laundry room, a bedroom, and a kitchen. Derek was unable to answer the questions, so Anna directed his hands to help him select the correct photographs. Anna believed that Derek was intelligent, but his ability was trapped behind his physical limitations. She claimed that Derek understood a lot more than people thought he did. For example, he knew the alphabet and could spell a few words. Based on this, the meeting appeared to be successful. Anna offered hope in the form of unlocking Derek's potential. Daisy took Derek to see Anna every couple of weeks. Using a keyboard with a built-in screen, Anna assisted Derek in pressing buttons to write words and sentences. According to Anna, Derek continued to make progress. He was selecting letters at a rate of 1 per second, reading books, and there was talk about him enrolling in a GED program. Even though his success appeared to be stunning, when Derek's mother and brother tried to use facilitated communication, it didn't work at all. Frustrated by the lack of success, John went to search for the film that he had seen in Anna's class. During his search, he found an online news article about how facilitated communication was not scientifically valid. As John was becoming increasingly suspicious, Derek's mother had concerns as well. She was clashing with Anna about Derek's preferences and independence. For example, they argued about whether Derek should move into a supervised living setting. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. After spending a lot of time with Derek, Anna believed she was having romantic feelings for him. In March 2011, she told him, "I love you." According to Anna, he responded by typing the message, "I love you too." Anna claimed that Derek was ready to take the relationship to the next level. On one Sunday, when Daisy was at church, Anna went to Derek's house. She loosened his diaper and engaged in oral sex. Derek did not experience an orgasm. A week later, Anna attempted to have sex with him in her office, but it did not work out. After this, Anna tried again. This time, the act was completed. Anna indicated that Derek was very happy and typed, quote, "I feel alive for the first time in my life," unquote. After these sexual encounters, Anna decided it was time to tell John and Daisy about the romantic relationship. She visited Derek's house on May 30, 2011, Memorial Day, and said that she was in love with Derek. In addition, she mentioned the sexual component and proclaimed that Derek was a man in every sense of the word. John and Daisy did not take this news very well. Not long after this, they told Anna that she could no longer see Derek. They did not have an interest in contacting the police, but in August of 2011, they decided to, after Anna wrote an email to the director of Derek's afternoon day program asking to see Derek. The police had Daisy call Anna and record the conversation. During this call, Anna admitted to having sex with Derek on 2 occasions. Anna was charged with 2 counts of first-degree aggravated sexual assault. She went to trial in 2015. Anna's argument was that through facilitated communication, Derek demonstrated consent to have sex. In an unusual move, the judge did not allow Anna to introduce evidence about FC, which obliterated her defense. On October 2, 2015, Anna was found guilty on both counts. On January 15, 2016, she was sentenced to 12 years in prison on each count to be served concurrently. Because of the blunder made by the judge, Anna was able to get her conviction overturned on appeal on June 9, 2017. The court ruled that she should have been permitted the opportunity to introduce FC as part of her defense. As it turns out, there would be no second trial. On March 19, 2018, Anna pleaded guilty to third-degree aggravated criminal sexual contact. On May 11 of that same year, she was sentenced to time served. She had spent 22 months in prison. Anna will also have to spend the rest of her life on parole supervision. Derek's legal guardians, John and Daisy, were awarded $4 million in a civil suit against Anna, but it is highly unlikely they will collect any of that money.
Unerwartete Reparaturen, plötzliche Schäden. Da verschluckt sich sogar der stärkste Löwe. Aber keine Sorge, mit der Bayerischen haben sie den löwenstarken Schutz für ihr Zuhause garantiert. Schützen Sie Ihr Zuhause jetzt vor den häufigsten Überraschungen. Erfahren Sie mehr auf www.diebayerische.de.
Willkommen bei der Frosta Fischstäbchen-Hotline. Für Knusprigkeit wählen Sie die 1. Für glückliche Kinder wählen Sie die 1. Für den Testsieger bei Stiftung Warentest wählen Sie auch die Nummer 1. Frosta Fischstäbchen. Wie immer nach dem Frosta Reinheitsgebot. Gibt's im Supermarkt.
Frosta ist für alle da.
Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number 1. Before Anna found herself in trouble, she was highly vocal on various social issues. She believed it was her responsibility to repair the world. Anna wanted to be a force of good and make a difference. She had a particular interest in how a white person could relate to a black person. She would talk about the horrors and conundrums of whiteness and recognize that well-meaning white people can actually harm black people when trying to advocate for them. Anna argued that intelligence was a social construct, just like gender, race, and sexuality. She did not believe in IQ tests, arguing they were a tool of anti-black oppression. Item number 2, there is no question that facilitated communication is nonsense. The whole idea behind this method is for the facilitator to help a person with a disability express themselves by holding their arms and directing their hands to push buttons on a keyboard. In reality, facilitators end up selecting the letters themselves. Therefore, they are the ones communicating. These facilitators may be well-intentioned, like they may not believe they are being deceptive, but their behavior is still harmful. Anna was aware about FC being invalid, but she thought that the critics went too far. For example, Anna said, quote, "Although opponents of FC present themselves as engaging in scientific debate, some instances of continuing anti-FC expression meet the criteria to count as hate speech," unquote. She believed that anyone insisting that FC never worked was promoting a form of ableist oppression. Item number 3. Some people have argued that Anna would have never been attracted to Derek under normal circumstances, implying that her relationship with him was based on her unusual sexual interests or she had some special affinity for a power imbalance. In particular, they pointed out how Derek wore diapers. Anna explained her attraction in this way, quote, "You know how you can meet someone who is extremely physically attractive, and then when you get to know them, they have such a horrible personality that they don't really look attractive to you. It works the same way in reverse. If somebody has an interesting, engaging mind and good heart and a beautiful soul, that is transformative. It shows through, and you love the person. And so you love being close to them, and you love the body that they're in because that's the body that they have," unquote. Item number 4, was Anna actually guilty? In my opinion, yes. The case against her is straightforward. Multiple mental health clinicians said that Derek had limited intellectual ability and was not capable of consenting. Anna was aware of this when she first met Derek. She was not qualified to declare that he was misdiagnosed. If she had been qualified, that alone would have precluded her from having a relationship with him. So either way, no relationship was possible. Furthermore, Anna was in a position of power. She really didn't have any valid excuse for her behavior. Item number 5, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. Anna appeared to be self-centered, grandiose, manipulative, and exceedingly creepy. She lied to herself, had magical thinking, or maybe even had delusions. After working with Derek, Anna convinced herself that he had an incredible intellect trapped behind a physical disability, and only she could release his true nature. Only she could unlock his potential and save him from the disability. Anna deceived herself into believing that Derek was actually communicating in a profound and complex way. Furthermore, he was overwhelmingly attracted to her, wanted to have sex with her, and wanted to be with her forever. Anna blamed Derek for the relationship, but phrased it like a compliment. Anna said that Derek seduced her and deserved some credit for that. She engaged in exploitation while making it sound like empowerment. In a sense, Anna was in love, but not with Derek. She was in love with herself and her own vision of a just society. She convinced herself that because of Derek's race and his disability, he needed someone with her belief system. She transformed him into her image of the ideal man, one who she could completely control. And she projected her own interests onto Derek. For example, Anna insisted that Derek liked red wine instead of beer and classical music instead of gospel. Unable to communicate complex thoughts, Derek was like a blank slate. Pulling from every aspect of her life, Anna simply wrote her own love story on this slate. If it was actually possible to liberate Derek's mind from his physical disability, there was no need to involve sex. Before even thinking about that, Anna should have had multiple mental health clinicians evaluate Derek and confirm that he was competent to make his own decisions. His ability to communicate his intentions should have been independently verified. Anna did not take these steps because she knew that she was the one creating all of Derek's communications. Now moving to my final thoughts. This case has caused debate about how people with disabilities should be treated. There are many people who defend Anna and suggest that the state of New Jersey unfairly prosecuted her. The state is ableist, narrow-minded, and does not value people with disabilities. I'm no fan of New Jersey, but in this case, the state was right. They defended a person with a disability against a misguided and manipulative individual who was unwilling to see the truth. No one who respected Derek would have treated him as Anna did. She did not unlock his potential, rather she unlocked her desires.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.